Lecture 14, Stoics, Epicureans, and Skeptics.
Hello, this is our 14th lecture in the series on Alexander and the Hellenistic Age, and today we're going to turn our attention to philosophy. We've been looking at the culture of the Hellenistic Age, and we've been able to see how the artists, the sculptors, the poets, and the authors of the Greek romances produced an art that was highly distinctive, very different from the classical age that came before. And we've been seeing the way in which the concerns of the age are expressed in this art. We've seen an age which is gripped by uncertainty, an age where people are very suspicious both of authority and deeply worried that fate is a capricious entity that could overthrow their lives at any moment. We would expect, of course, that the philosophers of the age would engage with some of these issues to try to give people an idea of how life comes about, how the universe exists, and then also how ethically one should live in the world. These are the traditional concerns of philosophy. So what I'd like to do today is to chart the ways in which the philosophical trends of the Hellenistic Age intersect with the major cultural trends that we've been seeing in other genres. We should begin, however, by observing that the Greeks of the Hellenistic Age came at the end of a long and fruitful tradition of philosophical inquiry. The philosophers did not spring up overnight in the Hellenistic Age. In fact, as early as the 6th century BC, long before the Hellenistic period, philosophers of the so-called Ionian Enlightenment, the philosophers often known collectively as the pre-Socratics, had already charted some of the trajectories that Greek philosophy would follow. These philosophers were interested in cosmology, in the essence of the universe, and they had asked the question, what is the essential substance out of which the cosmos, the universe, is made? They had provided various answers to this. Some had maintained that it was water. Some had maintained that it was air. Others had said the universe is made up of tiny indivisible particles, an idea that seems strange until you realize that they're talking about atoms. Atoms being quite literally the smallest particles that cannot be cut, according to the Greek philosophers, though we, of course, have shown that that's not exactly true. The Ionian philosophers before Socrates, as well as being natural philosophers, observing nature and trying to understand the cosmos, had also been ethical philosophers. How should man live? What is the nature of justice? What is the good? These Ionian philosophers of the 6th and the 5th century were then succeeded by the three men who are traditionally seen as the fountainhead of Greek philosophy and, in fact, of European philosophy in general. And though this still is before the Hellenistic Age, I should at least summarize their work so that we have some idea of how the Hellenistic philosophers had been trained, who their intellectual antecedents were, and what the tracks of Greek philosophy were. Well, of course, the greatest of the three is Socrates, and it is Socrates who perfected the art of inquiry through cross-examination, through methodical questioning. Socrates had been told by the oracle at Delphi that he was the wisest man in Greece. He thought that this was a peculiar pronouncement and set out to test it by asking other people what they knew. And it was in the course of inquiring of other people about their opinions that he came to the realization that while he knew that he wasn't the smartest man, other people, because they did think that they knew what they were talking about, were actually less intelligent than he. So ironically and paradoxically, he did confirm the view that he was the wisest man of Greece. His philosophy was largely one based on questioning. Let me give you an example of the way in which this works paradoxically. If you ask a group of undergraduates in college, should universities allow students to drink, they will usually say yes. Universities have to recognize that if a student is 21 and is an adult, he therefore or she has the right to drink, and universities should acknowledge that and allow them to do so. Well, Socrates, or the Socratic method, would approach this by saying, now, are those people who drink more healthy than those who do not? And Socrates' interlocutor would say, of course not, Socrates. People who drink are less healthy than those who do not. And Socrates would say, so drinking therefore is not a healthy activity. And the interlocutor would have to say, that is correct. And Socrates would then say, now should universities encourage healthy or unhealthy activities? And the person would say, this is obvious, universities should encourage healthy activities. That's why they have gymnasia and sports teams and so forth. And Socrates would conclude, well, if universities should encourage healthy activities, and if drinking is not a healthy activity, then surely universities should not allow drinking. And in this model dialogue that I've just made up on the spot, Socrates' interlocutor would have to come back with a reply such as one does find in the Platonic dialogues, something along the lines of, it seems, Socrates, as if I didn't know what I was talking about. The Socratic style that we have preserved in the Platonic dialogues usually illustrates Socrates' belief that all virtues are essentially the same, that justice, goodness, and piety are all really versions of the same essentially unified virtue. Plato, the second of the great Greek philosophers of the classical age, revered his master Socrates, and he made him the mouthpiece in a series of dialogues, the Platonic dialogues, for a philosophy which seems to seamlessly blend the philosophy of the two individuals, Socrates and Plato. Plato, for example, takes the idea of virtues a step further by arguing that, in fact, there is a more perfect realm beyond this where forms exist in their most perfect type, and that what we have in this world is merely a set of imperfect reflections of that, so that lights, sound, trees outside, cups, lecterns, cameras, these are all merely instances in this imperfect world of the more perfect versions of these in the realm of forms or the realm of perfect ideas. And so in this Platonic philosophy, permanence is really an illusion, because at any given time, an object is in the process of becoming something else. A sapling grows to be a tree. A tree is then cut down and cut to become a plank. A plank is then used to make a deck, and a deck is part of a house. So that the same substance is constantly undergoing change. It is metamorphosing. Aristotle, the third of the great Greek philosophers of the classical age, approached phenomena slightly differently. Instead of looking for what is essential and perfect, which is then copied in this imperfect realm, he rather tried to deduce the essence of things by categorizing all the instances of phenomena. So that, for example, if you wanted to understand what is a table in essence, Aristotle's approach would be to line up 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 different tables side by side and say, what is it that they each have in common? Now, this approach proved to be highly influential in Western philosophy because it could be applied in so many areas. If you want to understand politics, for example, in the Aristotelian model, you go to each one of the Greek city-states and you copy down its constitution. And you can find the best form of political constitution by comparing all of the known examples. Or you can find out about the weather by observing the weather every day and in different parts of the Greek world or in different parts of the Mediterranean. So this scientific notion of observation leading to deduction is really the legacy of Aristotelian thought. By amassing as much evidence as possible regarding a phenomenon, whether it be plants or ethics or meteorology or constitutions, Aristotle believed that one would be able to determine what its proper function or purpose was. So these are the tendencies, a mystical tendency in Plato and a deductive typological approach in Aristotle that are inherited by the Hellenistic Age. And the Hellenistic Age will continue these philosophical trends associated with Plato and with Aristotle, but the difference is that in the Hellenistic Age this will be done in a much more formal institutional setting. Instead of a single teacher and a group of dedicated students, we now can speak of philosophical schools, in a sense, the first European universities. Philosophers were no longer itinerant teachers moving from city to city, but rather were the heads of schools offering regular courses of lectures. And when they retired or died, they would be succeeded then by specifically chosen followers. So that we're really talking about institutional philosophy. And the two institutions that are most connected with the earlier Platonic and Aristotelian traditions of Greek philosophy are the Academy and the Peripatetics. Let me explain who these are briefly. The Academy took its name from the meeting place of the philosophical school that claimed descent from Plato and his followers. Influenced by Socratic and Platonic doubts regarding the certainty of knowledge, Socrates had already established that most of us, if questioned closely enough, can't really support most of the things that we believe as true knowledge. Influenced by this approach, the Academy became more and more closely associated with the point of view that says you can never really know anything with absolute certainty. In other words, they were the original skeptics. Skeptics attempted to demonstrate the impossibility of knowledge, as they called it, akatalepsia. And they argued, therefore, that we should suspend judgment and base it merely upon the most likely of circumstances or opinions. But there was no absolute certainty. You could never say absolutely what was true. Peripatetic philosophy, on the other hand, was associated much more closely with the followers of Aristotle, who met at another location in Athens known as the Lyceum. Here, as at the Academy, there was a garden, there was a set of buildings around the garden, and this provided the physical setting in downtown Athens where the Aristotelian tradition continued of wide-ranging research. And this really is the origin of the modern research institute. The philosophers that met here were usually known as the Peripatetics, deriving their name from the fact that some of the early lecturers would walk around. This is what peripatetic means. They would walk around as they were delivering their lectures. And like Aristotle, their founder, these peripatetic philosophers covered a range of topics in their philosophy, both physical science, geography, mathematics, astronomy, and so forth, as well as literary criticism too. So we find in the Hellenistic age the traditions of the classical world leading on into new directions. In addition to these schools, which are really connected to the classical period that came before, the Hellenistic age also saw the development of new schools of philosophy that began now really for the first time. And the two most influential that we should mention are Stoicism and Epicureanism. Both the older schools and the newer schools of Hellenistic philosophy treated philosophy as an area of inquiry that really had three distinct sub-areas, if you will: physics, logic, and ethics. Stoicism was founded by Zeno of Citium, a Greek city on the island of Cyprus. He came to Athens towards the end of the 4th century, and for the rest of his life there he taught philosophy. He's supposed to have said that fortune did me a favor by driving me to philosophy, thereby expressing perfectly a very Hellenistic sentiment that his entire life had really been dictated by fortune. Stoicism placed a great emphasis on personal morality, and it was based on the belief that human beings have the capacity through their human reason to grasp the true nature of the world in which we live. And of course, in this respect, they were very different from the skeptics who maintained that real and absolute knowledge was not possible. The physical theory on which the Stoics based their ethical point of view was that the world was made up of a universal fire. This was the substance that made up the entire cosmos. And of course, each one of us, according to this theory, also has some spark of that universal divine fire in us. So that it is a philosophy that had a kind of theological overtone, if you will, and really was very comforting to people who believed that we really do have something of the divine in us. It is a theory which became enormously popular in the Roman world. It stayed popular throughout the Greek East, but also when the Romans became more familiar with the Greek world, it took off there too. And I think one of the reasons for this we can see when we read Cicero's interpretation of this philosophy, when he's talking here about the gods. He says, "The cosmos as a whole has been discussed, so have the heavenly bodies. We now have a pretty clear picture of a large number of gods who are not idle, but who do not have to carry out the tasks they perform with laborious and unpleasant effort. For they are not held together by veins and nerves and bones, nor do they consume the sort of food and drink which would make their humours either too sharp or too dense. Nor do they have the sorts of bodies which would lead them to dread falls or blows or fear diseases produced by physical exhaustion. It was for fear of this sort of thing that Epicurus invented his insubstantial and idle gods. Endowed with that most beautiful of shapes, located in the purest region of the heavens, they move and steer their courses in such a way that they seem to have come to an agreement to preserve and protect everything." And he says, it remains for me to explain that the world is governed by the providence of the gods. So this was a Greek philosophy that had clear connections with the earlier approaches of the cosmologists of the 6th century, trying to argue for an essence in the universe, but it didn't threaten traditional religion. Rather, it suggested that the gods are simply not quite as anthropomorphic as we may have considered them to be. A much more radical break with traditional culture and with traditional philosophy, in some respects, was that of Epicureanism, the philosophy that takes its name from its founder, Epicurus. He's the one Hellenistic philosopher whose name is well known to many people, and his philosophy is completely misunderstood. So it behoves us to say a little about what Epicureanism truly is. Often reviled both in antiquity and in modern times as a hedonist because of his dictum that the pleasurable is good, which seems to be a free license, Epicurus, in fact, was the exact opposite of this. He advocated an austere and ascetic existence. The Epicureans held that sensual gratification, that wonderfully rich meal that you had last night, that bottle of wine that's waiting for you at home tonight, only fuels desire because you want another rich meal to match the one that you had, and you spend your life thinking of that next bottle of the perfect Chardonnay. And therefore, according to Epicurus, this didn't contribute to happiness at all because you became a slave of your desires. On the other hand, he said, denial and abstinence suppress desire. You stop wanting it if you stop feeding those desires in your body. And that makes true happiness attainable. Epicurus actually said that he would be as happy as Zeus if he merely had a barley cake and a cup of water. And like the other philosophies, this moral philosophy was also based on a physical theory. Epicurus maintained that the world was made up of atoms and that there was really nothing beyond this, that when you die, the atoms disperse, and that's all she wrote. There's nothing left, he would say. Later on, this philosophy also became quite popular in the Roman world, and a Roman poet named Lucretius praised Epicurus for having freed mankind from the fear of death, because of this notion that once we die, since there is nothing after death, we should have no reason to fear it beforehand. A common theme running through the philosophies of the Hellenistic age, both the traditional and the newer ones, is the search for inner harmony and peace. And this makes good sense if you think back to the tortured sculpture that we've seen, and if you think back to the interest in heightened emotion, passion and rage that we've seen in the novels and the poems of the Hellenistic age. The philosopher's response to the uncertainty of the time was to turn inwards and to look for inner harmony, a state that they called ataraxia, which literally means freedom from disturbance, not being upset, in other words. and it led many people to find in the philosophical life an alternative to the turbulent political conditions of the age. The followers of Epicurus, for example, retreated from active public life into a compound which was referred to as the garden, where they formed an almost a quasi-religious brotherhood. One of the great ironies of history is that though Epicurus had believed that death is final, his followers actually revered him after his death as a kind of demigod. Perhaps they didn't understand the professor's lectures very well. Because the Epicureans believed that life consisted of sense perception, they regarded death as nothing to be feared, since they rejected all superstitions concerning an afterlife. And Epicurus actually wrote in a letter to one of his friends, get used to believing that death is nothing to us. The Stoics emphasized indifference towards material wealth. Zeno asked, why must the wise man make money? Only virtue is worth pursuing for the sake of happiness, and virtue is indifferent to wealth. So why bother to be a merchant? Why bother to give money to the city or to build a larger house? And the most extreme version of this disengagement from the contemporary world, if you will, is that of the cynics. Now, little of the writing of these men survives, and it's probably wrong to think of it as a philosophical school. The cynics are more really a way of life or an attitude. They model themselves on the first and the best known of the cynics, Diogenes, who lived in a barrel and gave up all social convention. No clothes. Clothes aren't in nature. You don't see beasties running around at the zoo with clothes on. So why should humans? It's unnatural. We don't live in houses that are created by nature. We build them. Therefore, they're unnatural. So you should live in something simple. Find yourself a large barrel, a cave, a hole in the ground. The aim of this cynic way of life was to live in accordance with nature, and it therefore rejected all social convention as unnatural. This meant that not only was clothing rejected, but so was personal hygiene, so were good manners, and various other practices. I'm not going to go into the gory details, I'll leave it to your imagination. Now, despite the tendency towards social withdrawal and the emphasis on purely individual and personal concerns, Hellenistic philosophy actually played a very important role in the communal life of the age. At Athens, for example, philosophers provided an alternative figure of charismatic leadership. An alternative to what? An alternative to the real kings of the Hellenistic age. We've already noticed in the Hellenistic novels the way that many of the pirates and the brigands are called kings, almost as if people are seeing them as a scaled-down version of what the real kings are. Well, the other development of the age is that philosophers become, in a sense, the negative image of kings as well. Kings were figures of enormous and unpredictable power. They're often distant, but the philosophers were intimately real. They were human. They preached where you could actually listen to them and see them. And their doctrines emphasized the importance of the inner life. In a sense, the thrust of their philosophy was to make every man a king, controlling his own destiny. These doctrines and their proponents gained popularity throughout the Hellenistic world, until it became commonplace, in fact, for cities to erect statues to philosophers as readily as to their other benefactors. So if you go today to a city like Aphrodisias, and if you look at the sculpture of a mid-level city of Asia Minor that flourished from the 1st century BC through to about the 3rd century AD, yes, you'll see many statues of local magistrates and even later of Roman emperors, but you'll also see dozens of statues showing philosophers. They are the intellectual heroes of the day. Philosophers, in fact, even become the ambassadors of the Greek states. And when one of the first official embassies comes from the Greek world to Rome, this emerging superpower on the western edge of the Mediterranean, of the Hellenistic Mediterranean, it is led by philosophers like Carneades, who bamboozles the Roman Senate by arguing in favor of justice on one day and against justice on the next day. A typical example of a smart-aleck Greek philosophy professor leading to a great deal of contempt on the part of his Roman hosts. As the living embodiment of Greek tradition, these men represented a human, individual Greek culture that was accessible to all in a way that the court of the Hellenistic king was not. Political power was restricted to a very small echelon at the top of society. But philosophical power, self-control, freedom from disturbance, was as simple as stepping away from the world, giving up public office, and living in a garden, subsisting on a diet of beans and water. The writings of these philosophers reflect this unusual pairing, this kind of inverse coupling, if you will, of the king and the philosopher. So, for example, in one instance, we find Plutarch commenting that the Stoics had said, when they write about politics to discourage us from practicing politics. And they write about rhetoric to discourage us from practicing rhetoric, and about kingship to discourage us from consorting with kings. When Zeno writes that the means of making money are ridiculous, such as receiving money from a king and therefore yielding to the influence of the king, the rejection that comes in those lines is not merely a rejection of materialism. He's not just saying you shouldn't worry about money because money isn't the road to virtue. What he's also doing is rejecting the entire contractual arrangement that makes up the Hellenistic world. The arrangement whereby you give honor to the king, you treat him as a god made manifest, and in return he acts as a benefactor for you and for your community. So there is, in fact, something almost subversive, if you will, about these philosophies. Because taken to their extreme, they would mean that people no longer lived as citizens in their state or kingdom. And one of them actually said, when asked of what state was he a citizen, replied, he was a citizen of the cosmos. Now in Greek, when you say that, you're saying, I am cosmopolitan. He wasn't saying he was sophisticated. He was saying, I reject your notion of this kingdom, or of that state, or of this city, and being citizens or subjects. I am a citizen of the universe, a cosmopolitan. Now, other Stoics explicitly likened the virtuous or the wise man to a king, claiming that both the virtuous man and the king were self-sufficient and therefore powerful. And so often the wise and the virtuous man is referred to as blessed. Now, it's very important to recognize that this phenomenon goes back to the Hellenistic age because it would become tremendously influential in the Roman Empire and would play a very important role in the future trajectory of both Judaism and of Christianity. Because many scholars have noted that it is under the Roman Empire that we find many people turning away from the power of Caesar or of the local governor and instead investing the holy man with a different kind of authority. So that in the Hellenistic world we find the roots of a powerful and important phenomenon, the creation of an alternative model of power. Not political power, but something which would challenge it. The power of philosophy, and finally the power of the holy man. And of course, the great irony of Christianity and later European history would be that that church which grew up as an alternative to the power of the Roman state would eventually, as a result of a rapprochement in the 4th century, become itself modelled on the Roman state and would become as official an institution as the state that it copied. So there is a thread that connects the Hellenistic philosophers who said, I don't want anything to do with this life, and the later emergence of Christianity as an opposition to the empire and the final transformation of that into a church. We see then that as in so many ways, so many other ways, the Hellenistic world plays a hidden and unseen but extraordinarily influential role in the later development of European history.